Hey, how about you?
Fantastic. You just joined us and you missed an amazing introduction. So sorry to let you know that. Anyway, it's wonderful to have you here. We're speaking with, is it Laura or Laura?
Laura, yeah.
Laura, thank you. Laura Mimosa Montez about your new poetry collection, Thresholds. And Laura, I'm going to ask you to give us a reading, but first I want to talk about the book and the term poetry. If we could start out with a big sort of discussion question, which is this. I almost feel like we need a different word besides poetry when we talk about your work. I think if I read a lot of poetry for the show and on my own, and if I pick up this book, I wouldn't even know what to call it, Laura. Aphorisms, epigrams, nonfiction, memoir, thoughts and ideas. What do you make of this book in terms of form, and how did you come about putting this together?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I'm always trying to redefine what poetry is in the act of writing it. I feel really invested in this pursuit of what is the line, what determines the length of the line, the feeling of the line, the moment when the line breaks. And I had a very clear agenda when I was writing and thinking about writing Thresholds. Like, I wanted to think about the line as some kind of energetic portal. And that, you know, portal being like every time you break it, you are interrupting time. You are jumping on to a new wave of information. So I was experimenting with that and all that, you know, could be contained in a line, and also thinking about the relationship between lines of poetry and their relationship to the sentence.
That's well described. And to give our listeners a sense of what you're talking about, so the book is a series of, in many cases, singular lines, which are alone are things to pause on and meditate about, if you will. Single quotes. I believe these are words attributed to particular writers and others, and then longer pieces. And these are all separated by small circles, and it all holds together in some sort of bead-like, pearl-like sort of way. I don't know how else to describe it. Do you have a reading in mind, Laura, so people maybe can get a flavor for what we're talking about?
Yeah. Would you like me to read from the book?
Yeah, it'd be lovely. That would be lovely.
Sure. Okay. So I'll read from the beginning to give you a sense. The book oscillates in between different registers of poetry, what feels like memoir, art history, and I embrace different voices, and often sometimes import quotation. Once you spoke without an accent, as if you came from nowhere. Nowhere is not a place. It is a modulation, a throbbing we carry within us, a process unremitting. It was sequential until it wasn't, and open to what is adjacent. There where the violence is, inside the soft tissue holding, wildflowers like wild parts of me always desiring and unfolding to speak of you beyond the rewriting, but how without a body? Daily I remind myself the future is not dependent on your inability to describe your undoing. I had every intention of beginning were it not for a narrowing, a tightening, the bands of color in which I saw myself surrounded, beautiful striations bending the time between rotations and the cut inside language insofar as that slash produces I, Python, a fiction.
Great. Thank you. Another thing I should note for our listeners, there are no titles, title breaks among these poems, among these lines. And so as a reader, there's no clear signaling, I guess I would say, from you about how we should think about the words on the page. Like, this is one group and this is one feeling or one emotion we're going to experience when we read this. That's obviously intentional on your part. Why did you make that choice?
Yeah, I wanted to write something that felt seamless, but also was composed of many parts. And so my experience when I open a poetry book is what I expect to be poetry is I open it and I have a visual relationship to it. So I always want to see how things are laid out on the page. And sometimes, you know, without knowing anything about an author or what the content of the poetry book is about, I'll base my decision on, you know, am I attracted to this, what's happening in this, based on, you know, my visual relationship to it. So I had this wish pre-pandemic that my book would be in the poetry section or the new releases section, you know, at the bookstore at Moon Palace, and people would flip through it and say, what is this? And they wouldn't be able to locate anything in their experience of reading poetry or memoir that would resemble this object that's littered with curious punctuation and these holes that you mentioned. So I wanted to, you know, scramble someone's visual encounter and expectation of poetry in that sense. And also to kind of disrupt reading conventions around what we expect when we think we're looking at poetry, or what we are expecting of an experience when we think we're reading memoir. Boy, I wanted to play with convention. Yeah.
You certainly did, Laura. And that is exactly what happened to me. I picked it up and I opened it up and I didn't know what to think, because I have the same relationship, visual relationship to poetry as you described. And whenever I talk to a poet on this show, I bring this up, which is to say, I see what the poem looks like first on the page and I immediately have some sort of reaction because it looks formal. So I assume there's some formality going on here, maybe in terms of, you know, rhythm or rhyme or whatever the case might be. Or things are broken up or spaced in all kinds of ways, and I immediately get a sense for what might be going on within the context of the poem. But you don't give us many signals here, if any.
I want people, readers, to get into the process more so than like experience a title, for example, as a signal or a signpost. I want... you know, one thing I do maybe that was intentional and functions similar to a title is that there's a preface in the book. Mm-hmm. And so I used a preface, which I wrote kind of, you know, after a lot of the book was done, as like my trigger warning, you know, like all ye, you know, consider this before you enter here, because I was struck by the idea that someone would feel, oh, unprepared, or sort of like, why isn't this doing this or that? And the sense of how can I conjure up a literary technique that usually isn't appear in a poetry collection, like a preface, you know, that sometimes appears like in a novel. How can I import these other literary conventions to speak to the reader before they even receive the first line of the text and be like, okay, if I go any further, I already get a sense of this is the land that we're living in.
Right, right. You hinted at this before, but I want to spend a little time, if we could, talking about the title of the book, Thresholds. There are a couple of words there, thresh, holes, and another word that's suggested, which is threshold. And holes and cuts and slices and things like that pop up a lot in this book. If you don't want to give away too much to our lovely readers out there, can we talk about what you were getting at here with this imagery, with these words?
Yeah, so thresholds is a word adopted from an artist from the 1970s, Gordon Mata Clark, and he had a lot of architectural and site-specific interventions, and one of the things he was known for were these building cuts. And so he had a kind of playful approach to thinking about space, and one of the photographs of, you know, his interventions on buildings was thresholds. And so he liked using words to play with ideas, and he was clearly playing on the idea, like you said, of threshold, you know, the space that joins two different rooms or spaces. Mm-hmm. And I was drawn to that as a concept. So I like to relate to other works of art as a way to think about language. I really feel as a writer that nothing is out of my range of what can I use? You know, sometimes I like to go to philosophy, or I like to go to film, or I like to go to sculptural work as a way to think about a writing problem. Right. So Thresholds is how I access a certain problem of thinking about holes as they appear throughout the work.
Nice. Thank you for that. You mentioned a lot of artists and other writers in the book. In terms of artists, big sculptural artists, one in particular is Richard Serra. And I love Richard Serra, his work. I don't know him. Describe for us Richard Serra's work, and people in Minneapolis would be familiar with a piece of his work in the Walker Sculpture Garden. Tell us about Richard Serra's work and why he shows up in your book.
Yeah, so Richard Serra had this curious sculpture in the Bronx. So, you know, parts of the Bronx and Minneapolis appear in Thresholds. And I was really interested in this, I think it's like called base plate hexagram, you know, the sculpture that he did, which was like on the street in the Bronx. And so part of Thresholds is this catalog of site-specific artworks that happened in the Bronx where I was born in the 1980s. Richard Serra complained that no one went to go see this artwork. Right. And it just got me thinking, like, you know, what is an artwork that isn't seen, you know, or how do we experience language that other people don't hear? Yeah, I love Richard Serra's work too. There's something about the materiality, and it's very masculine in a way, similar to Gordon Matza Clark. It's like ambitious. I relate to his use of materials for sure.
And in Minneapolis, and I'm going to talk about the Bronx, Minneapolis, but with you in Minneapolis in the Sculpture Garden, his piece is this big piece. Everything's big with Serra, I believe. I don't know if he's ever done anything relatively small, but giant steel plates that sort of tilt and lean and give a sense both for stability and flimsiness, if you will. But anyway, we have one of his beautiful pieces here in Minneapolis. And before we talk a little more about the Bronx and Minneapolis, I want to remind our listeners that we are speaking with Laura Mimosa Montez about her new poetry collection, I stress poetry, called Thresholds. By the way, published by Coffee House Press, one of our favorite local presses here. So let's talk about the Bronx and Minneapolis. And the Bronx is really kind of a star of the show in this book, right? In many respects, I think you could, it's kind of about the Bronx and your relationship with the Bronx. And yet Minneapolis shows up. So let's talk about the Bronx first, the impression it had on you, how much time you spent there. And maybe as you're telling this story, when you woke up to poetry and how poetry became a part of your life. That's a long question about your past, Laura.
No, I love it. Thank you. I was still thinking about Richard Serra and his the way that his works dig into the ground. Yeah, they really sort of transverse these different levels. And so I was interested in a similar process of how to scale across different geographies. And so I was born in the Bronx in 1987. And when I had been researching art history, I used to teach at MCAD, the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. I kept noticing how the Bronx shows up in a lot of just like as a biography, like this interesting site where a lot of cool artists were from. So like Lawrence Weiner was working in the Bronx, and like Richard Serra's Bronx work. Like I just kept seeing the Bronx popping up in all these ways that I didn't really like anticipate. And it's like, oh, I want to think about myself in relation and in lineage. So I'm trying to, you know, how do I connect that with being a writer? I think I was trying to explore in Thresholds something about how we come to know ourselves through space is also a story of how we come to know ourselves through language and through body. So I don't have necessarily an argument about, you know, my relationship to the Bronx or to Minneapolis so much as I like to span these different times and places as a way to think about how we talk about ourselves through narrative and how we can go through any kind of, you know, visual landscape or geographic landscape or urban landscape and come up with some kind of pastiche collage of all these things. And that somehow is narrative, or that somehow is poetry. And I always like to encourage people to connect with their own sense of place or body or time or art, you know, so they can sort of see for themselves how are they reflected in these objects and in these narratives and in these histories.
Wow, that's beautiful. I love this description of your connection, the description of your relation, the relationship between geographic space and language. I thought that was lovely. Thank you for that. So when did you discover poetry for yourself? When did it become important to you?
I remember writing children's books when I was a kid. I remember attempting to write a book, teaching others how to write a book. I don't know why this was in my like drives. Like, I think I was maybe like 8 years old and I was like, I'm going to write a book, like an instruction manual about how others should write. And I don't even know why. Like, I think I was like, I've made 3 books already. One was like about a dog that was also a surfer. So when did I move into a poetry? Probably in high school, when I started to like have a relationship to lyric by way of music. And I was starting to read things like Emily Dickinson and Lorca, and I was very interested in those modes of experience and those ways of talking about reality. I was like moody, so it appealed to me.
Ah, well, you're made to be a poet if you're moody, right? It's a given. Put that mood to work. So you're a teacher, right, Laura?
You teach poetry? I do teach, although I'm not teaching currently. In another universe, I would have been teaching at NYU this semester, but things played out differently. So
yes, they did. Well, let me ask you about teaching poetry, and I'll just ask it directly. Can you teach poetry? Can you teach someone to write poetry? Or does it come from that mood?
I love that question. I ask myself all the time, you know, can you teach someone, do you want to teach someone how to do something? I've tried to reframe it as, for people who are interested in accessing a mode of experience, what does that mean? Like, for people who want to explore how you can use language as a material, I think anybody can do that. I don't think you have to be moody. I think there are many kinds of poetry in the world. There's conceptual poetry. There was just published an anthology of concrete poetry written by women, and it's very pictorial and abstract. Maybe it looks moody in a visual register, but I do like to work with people who are coming to writing for the first time. I don't know, you know, like people, I like working with artists who are trying to reframe a relationship to their practice through language. So I definitely believe, more so than teaching, welcoming people into the practice.
Yeah. Well, good for you. That you'd be a good teacher then. I think that's really important. You tell a story in the book, the details will escape me, but it'll come to you, where some particular art was defaced. And the artist responded that it turned out so much better. I believe graffiti was added to...
Right, it was Sophie Cowell's work.
Thank you. So what does that mean to you, that when the artist said, when the art was in effect vandalized or whatever term you want to use, defaced, that it became so much better? I thought that was a powerful moment, but you leave us alone with that thought. So I want to know what you think about that as an artist, as a writer.
Sure, yeah. I love Sophie Cowell. She's a conceptual artist, and also she's published books. So there's this kind of merging between her writing and her practice, which often involves people, strangers. So this artwork was an early one of hers that I was writing about, and I was interested in her openness to chance. You know, she thought she had a concept of this artwork in which she interviewed or invited people to visit her, let's say, at this gallery in the 1980s in the South Bronx. Mm-hmm. And then she, you know, when people visit her at the gallery, she's like, take me anywhere you want. So already that's like a level of trust, you know, like, imagine. And this was at a time when people were really like, oh, the Bronx isn't a safe place. So she was, you know, this French woman inviting people to take her wherever they wanted. And then she'd photograph them and write a small prose paragraph about their experience. So she already kind of was lending herself to these strangers. And then she hangs up the show, and then, you know, it's quote unquote defaced, or there's like graffiti that shows up. So, and the result is that it's better. And I guess I almost sort of leave it without interpretation or judge the gesture, because it's, for me, that's, it's like providence or like fated, mm-hmm. like, oh, mm-hmm. like Sophie Cal opens and avails herself to chance. And it just happens, like, you can look it up online, Sophie Cal, the Bronx. The effect of the graffiti makes the project so much more interesting, like aesthetically. It's like another layer, and it totally fits in with the ways that she invited other people, you know, to help her make this project.
Are you a visual artist too, Laura, or should we, given what we've just heard, consider your writing the visual art?
I don't. That's a great question. Maybe it reveals my hesitation or anxiety about claiming an artist identity, because I know, right? I know and work with people who like live off their art and have studio spaces. So I guess I can say that I sometimes integrate visual components into my writing, and sometimes I also deviate and just, you know, like, collaborate, let's say, with a filmmaker on something. And I you know, like to contribute to the concept of talking about what the final work is. But am I like sitting in the editing room, or am I like holding the camera? Not always. So in that way, I do resonate with the conceptual art, the land of ideas, more so than the like land of drawing and painting, let's say.
Okay. So if we did a Google search for you, we wouldn't find some stuff out there besides your writing?
Oh, you'll definitely find me doing performance work. That was a moment in my, a few years ago, I was using performance to explore something about poetry on the line and audience. And I was taking a lot of dance workshops at the time. There's some collage work where I'm thinking about place in relation to Puerto Rico. That was shortly after Hurricane Maria. On YouTube, you'll find a video collaboration that I did with Jay Matthews of Boy Harsher. And I worked on the text, and she made a film sort of in tandem with that. So you'll find some experiments of mine, yeah.
Fantastic, that's great. Believe it or not, we're nearing the end of our time. And before we get the countdown from the amazing Annie back in the studio, we're doing this via Zoom, as I'm sure everyone assumes. We are talking to Laura Mimosa Montes about her newest collection of poetry, Thresholds, out from Coffee House Press. And let's talk about what you might be working on coming up. What's next for Laura while we have a chance here?
Sure. I've just really enjoyed this interview. What am I working on now? I'm thinking about things that come up in Thresholds. So, you know, Thresholds, I often prefigured as a book about touch. And it's sort of weird to publish a book about touch in a time where touch is taboo. So I think I'm returning again to this question in this new book that I'm thinking of that is actually not poetry and maybe more narrative. Maybe it'll read more like fiction, where touch and intimacy enter in as zones of inquiry.
Wow. And what shape this will take, who knows? You probably don't even know yet. Is that right? Is that how you approach your work?
Yeah, I like to be led by the work. So right now I'm in the sort of, what am I gravitating to? What am I attracted to?
And I'm starting to fall in love with the ideas and the concept of, you know, and the rules are starting to shape. So there's not going to be any references. There's not going to be any art history. There's not going to be line breaks. Those are the things that I'm starting to fall in love with as concepts. And then looking towards writers like David Wojnarowicz, who's an artist and also, you know, who's also a writer, as models for like, what is the voice and what is the kind of desire that I want to move closer to?
Did you wake up every morning and love to ask, especially ask poets this about how they work? We have a precious few seconds left. Do you wake up ready to go to work, get the cup of coffee and sit down? Or do you wait for, you know?
No. I write sporadically and, you know, it's a little chaotic. So I really embrace it when it comes to me, but I also like to let it percolate and foment and ferment. It's a process of fermentation for me, not like a daily brew.
Really? Okay. And then you come back and work on it, I'm sure. I believe you're an editor also, so you probably love rewriting your work more than you love writing it, if you're like a lot of writers.
100%. I don't like generating new material. I like working on raw stuff.
Yeah. It sounds like you have a solid idea going forward for the next one. I keep asking about it because I'm curious about what it's going to be. And maybe we'll see it show up, right? Because you publish in other journals and magazines, right?
Yeah. It'll be out there. When I'm ready to share, yeah, you'll see me. You'll see me all over the place sharing, here it is, new, because I'm always chasing the new, and the new is what excites me. So I'm glad to put it on people's radar.
Well, we're glad you published this book. It's wonderful. It's thought-provoking. It pushes genre. It challenges the reader, and we all should embrace a challenge these days. Well, boy, I'm getting the high five now. So I'm going to wrap it up. And ladies and gentlemen, this is Laura Mimosa Montez, M-O-N-T-E-X. Google her. Buy her book from Coffee House Press. And stay tuned for the next part of our show. I'm going to send it back to the amazing Annie in the studio. Laura, it's been a real treat.
Thank you so much, David. This has been really fun.
Wonderful. Talk to you again. Bye now.
And now we're on with Dave Fettig and Reid Forgave. Thank you so much. This is Right on Radio on 90.3 FM.
And thank you, amazing Annie and the fascinating Liz back in the studio. I'm on Zoom with Reid Forgave. Hi, Reid.
Hey, Dave. How are you?
Fantastic. Reid is the author of Love, Zach, Small Town Football, and the Life and Death of an American Boy. Reid, congratulations on the book. It's compelling, it's powerful, and you are getting a lot of attention for it, and well-deserved, I must say.
Thank you. It's been, it's my first book, as you know, and it's been an exhausting and emotional and thrilling couple of weeks. It was released the day after Labor Day, and had a few excerpts published in a couple of national publications, and I don't know if excerpts sell books or if they just do the opposite. Everyone's like, I've had enough. I read 7,000 words of this. I don't need any more.
We'll find out, right?
It was cool to get my name in Sports Illustrated. I wanted to have that since I was in, you know, like sixth grade. So that was cool.
Oh, man. That's true. Congrats on all of that. And everyone who is here for the introduction at the top of the show knows that Reid is a writer that has appeared in a number of magazines. Newspapers, and of course, is writes now for, in addition to other places, our very own Minneapolis Star Tribune. So, Reid, it's a book about football. It's a book about tragedy. It's a book about Middle America, and it's a book about America. It's really one of these sorts of pieces of all-around journalism, and we're going to talk a little more about that. But before I turn it over to you for a discussion, let's have an excerpt, if you would read from us. I think we want to get a sense for right up at the top what we're talking about here, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
If you want to set this up, Reid, please do.
Yeah, I will. And I'll offer, frankly, a trigger warning. This is a book about lots of very serious and depressing things. It's a book about suicide, about mental illness, about brain injury, about football, about masculinity and parenting. What I'm going to read is the prologue to this book. I don't know your rules, but I will self-censor the couple of swear words that are in this prologue.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No worries. Don't want to get kicked off the air. But I think this is actually, it's from Zach Easter is the title character of this book. It is from his first suicide attempt in November of 2015. which was 5 weeks before. I'm not spoiling anything. This, you know, in the first chapter of this book, that Zach is not going to live. But it is 5 weeks before his second and completed suicide attempt. I think that would be the correct phrasing. Yeah, I think this gets at a lot of the big picture themes that you just talked about.
Great. Thank you.
So, I'll just start right here. It's fairly short. Zach Easter stood on the long wooden dock leading out onto Lake Aquabi, gripping the .40 caliber pistol he'd given his dad for Father's Day not even 5 months before. The sun had dipped over the horizon on the other side of the Y-shaped lake. Leaves lay in heaps on the fringe of the woods. The gusty November winds died down as the sun sank on the horizon, but there was still a chill in the air. Winter was coming. Zach took out his phone and snapped a picture. He posted it to Snapchat, ignoring the frantic phone calls that were pouring into his phone. "God bless America," he captioned the photo. Where is Zach? All around Zach's hometown, friends and family were terrified. They'd seen his Facebook post a few minutes before. "If you're reading this, then God bless the times we've had together. Please forgive me. I'm taking the selfish road out. Only God understands what I've been through. I will always watch over you." They needed to stop him. But how? They didn't even know where he was. From the house where Zach grew up, a few miles away and amidst fields of corn, his parents called. Zach did not pick up. From the small town just down the street, where Zach had played high school football, and from Des Moines, the big capital city not quite 20 miles to the north, his friends called. Zach did not pick up. At 5:36 p.m., a college roommate texted him, "Hey, what are you up to, bud?" No reply. From the law school at Case Western Reserve University, almost 700 miles away in Cleveland, Ohio, Allie Epperson, Zach's girlfriend and the only person to whom he had fully confided his struggles with his rapidly deteriorating brain, called. Zach did not pick up. She called again. He did not pick up. She called again. Finally, Zach picked up. There was terror in his voice. "I can't do this," he told her. "It's never going to get better." Allie, a vivacious law student who in many ways was Zach's opposite, a bleeding heart liberal who balanced out Zach's dyed-in-the-wool conservatism, was freaking out. How many hours had she spent on the phone with him, talking about the disease that seemed to be eating his brain from the inside? How many times had the two talked about the sport he loved, the sport that had consumed much of his childhood, but now seemed to be consuming the rest of his life as well? How many times had she told him that a real man was not stoic and unfeeling, that a real man must face his demons instead of suffering silently in deference to some antiquated ideal of masculinity? How many times had she told him not to apologize to her, that she loved him despite the crazy stuff that was going on, and that they would work through it all together? Earlier on this day, Friday the 13th of all days in November 2015, he had apologized again. "I'm sorry you fell in love with a guy with a ducked up brain," Zach had texted her, his phone's autocorrect softening the swear word. He'd awoken early, started drinking, and called Allie in a panic late in the morning, drunk and swerving his car around the suburbs. She coaxed him to drive into a gas station, then into a Jimmy John's to grab a sandwich and sober up. She'd calmed him like she always did. He'd apologized like he always did. She'd texted him back. "You can't choose who you fall in love with. You just fall in love." Then he texted an ominous reply. "If anything happens to me, just by a chance of luck, tell my family everything." Now things were happening. A friend noticed the setting of Zach's Snapchat photo, the beach on Lake Aquabi, where Zach and Allie had escaped to in the summer to get away from high school friends and stare at the clouds. The lake was just down the road from his family's house. The lake's name is derived from an ancient Algonquian language. It means resting place. Allie kept Zach on the phone. "Listen to the sound of my voice," she soothed him. "Listen to the sound of my voice." "I'm losing my mind," he cried. "This is it for me." One Warren County Sheriff's Office cruiser came speeding down the winding hill toward the lake, followed by another. "Allie, did you send those cops here?" The cops got closer to him. He started apologizing to Allie, and he told her he wanted his brain donated for research. Then Zach's phone cut out. Out on the dock, Zach pointed the pistol at the darkened sky and fired a warning shot. That is when a pickup truck sped down the hill and slammed to a stop next to the lake. Zach's father, a burly former high school football coach named Miles Easter, jumped out. The parking lot quickly filled with squad cars. One deputy, a former all-conference linebacker who played for Miles on the same high school team Zach had played for, trained his assault rifle on Zach. Lasers from other police rifles danced on Zach's body. The evening was dark and it was getting cold. Miles saw the cherry red 2008 Mazda 3 Zach called Old Red. He peered into the window of his son's car. He saw an empty six-pack of Coors Light, an empty bottle of Captain Morgan rum, and a pill bottle. Floodlights illuminated Zach. A black curtain fell in the water behind him. Zach stood up from a picnic table and walked down the pier toward a wooden fishing hut at water's edge. A few more steps and he'd be inside, alone on the water, out of sight. "Put your gun down," the deputy shouted. "Nope," Zach yelled with an anguished laugh. "Not going to do that." In a flash, Zach's father realized what was happening. Zach wants the police to shoot him. "F it," Miles said to himself. "I can't let this happen." Zach's father sprinted past the sheriff's deputies and onto the pier. "Zach," he shouted. "If he shoots me, he shoots me," the father thought. "Dad, stop." As Miles Easter ran toward his son, Zach's face came into focus. His blue eyes looked foggy and confused. The expression on his still boyish face matched the tenor of his voice. Sad, sick, exhausted, scared, worn down by life, beaten once and for all. "Zach, I'm coming," Miles said. "Put your gun down." "Dad," Zach shouted. "Dad, stop." Then, gripping his father's pistol, Zach disappeared into the fishing hut. The door slammed shut behind him, and Zach Easter was alone.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is Reed Forgrave reading from Love, Zach. That's how the book starts, and I dare you to stop reading after that. Now, that's an intense and dramatic beginning. Thank you, Reed. The book is Love, Zach, again, Small Town Football and the Life and Death of an American Boy. We're on Right On Radio on KFAI. Reed, really a gripping piece of writing and one hell of a story. How did you come up? We have so much to talk about in so little time, of course. But let's talk about how you came into this story. And then you could talk to us about your relationship with the family, because this seems crucial to me to.
I used to work for the Des Moines Register in Des Moines, Iowa. I lived in Iowa for 10 years. And not long, a few years after I stopped at the Des Moines Register, I was a national sports writer. And an old friend passed on his obituary that was in my old newspaper. And it was right before Christmas, 2015. And there was this paragraph in the obituary that speaks about Zach's struggles with chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And to hear that from a 24-year-old man, right, who only played football through high school, it's just like, holy crap. And I reached out to his family, and it was just about 2 days. I'm sorry, not 2 days, 2 weeks after Zach's death. It was the first Sunday of 2016. And I was at their house for a Sunday afternoon. I spent 4 hours sitting on their in their living room on their carpet, talking about his life, talking about his death, talking about his childhood, talking about how, you know, in his mother's words, very bluntly, like, football killed him. And what struck me from that moment, like from that moment, I went there thinking, oh, this is a topical story. It's a tragic story. It's something I can, at the time I was writing for foxsports.com, maybe we could have a 3,000 word story and an accompanying documentary piece on Fox Sports One.
Yeah.
I come out of there thinking, oh my God, this is a book. I mean, it was like that, because he'd left behind all these journals that really revealed his first person account of his deep, dark, but not necessarily linear descent into this this darkness of CTE. But also, what also struck me in that moment, where I'm sitting on their floors behind me for almost the entire conversation, Sunday afternoon in January, guess what was on the TV? It was Vikings Packers. It was Zach's favorite team, the Packers, against his dad's favorite team, the Vikings, my adopted hometown team, the Vikings. Mm-hmm. And all the men in that room, myself included, we're looking back at that TV and we're checking our fantasy football scores. And we're talking about how football killed a 24-year-old man, or at least certainly contributed to it. And it really, the dissonance of that moment, as a big football fan myself,
yeah,
taught me that immediately that it said something profound about America, about our views on masculinity, and about our, you know, the way that we think about our favorite sport.
Right. Oh, that's so well described. And in that respect, you are a character in this book because you show up with your own views as you have just described. It'd probably be almost impossible to keep yourself out of this narrative because of what the story really entails. And just to repeat what you said and what I suggested earlier, this is a story about all of us. You don't have to be a football fan. You can hate football. This is still a story for you, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, on its surface, I think someone looks at this as a sports book, and it's not. It's a book about sports, but it's not a sports book. It's a book about parenting, I think, as much as anything. It's a book about masculinity.
Can I stop you there, Reed?
Yeah, please.
Because I really want to talk about his father.
Yeah.
Boy, what a hard story. What a hard thing to experience as a father. And yet, he just seemed like someone who didn't even crack. Did he really? I don't even know what I'm asking. What's your experience with the father in terms of his reaction to his son's suicide?
Yeah, his father is like, they have this thing called the Easter mentality. And people in Indianola know this. Miles Easter is the father. He has three sons. All of them played football. Miles Easter was a Division I football player. He coached for the small college in town, and then he became the defensive coordinator for the high school team, coached all three of his sons. And Miles Easter was a tough dude. He was what you think of as a football coach. He'll scream at you, and then he would do this thing where he'd yell and he'd be cussing and he'd be calling, you know, his teenage players all sorts of names at halftime, and then he'd say, he'd take a breath and he'd go, okie doke. And he turned to the whiteboard and be like, okay, now it's teaching time. He's a very traditional masculine character. And I don't think that's a coincidence, because if you look at his family, they've lived off the Zach Easter, his middle son, was a seventh generation Iowan, basically all on the same more or less plot of land in rural Iowa, not too far from Des Moines. They're farmers. They worked land. And they very much had this idea of, this is what a man is. A man gets stuff done. A man toughs things out. And that's who Miles was to his sons. And I think his reaction to his son's death is kind of what you'd expect from a man like that. He doesn't talk about it that much. He goes out and has a couple beers in the backyard and goes hunting with his two dogs. He's tortured by it. But he's not the type of guy, and I think he's quoted in this book saying, I don't need no effing therapy. That's not his style. And it's a way that his version of masculinity is sort of his blessing, but also his curse, because he's having a tough time with all of this, but you wouldn't know it from talking to him. I really like the guy, and I hope that came out in the book.
Yes, indeed it did. It is gut-wrenching to read the personal journal of Zach, to know this is going on, the amount that he was suffering physically and mentally, and people that loved him didn't know that at the time, and inadvertently were really complicit, I hate to use that term,
sure,
it's a softer term, in his downfall, but they didn't know. And you just want to be able to stop time and say, help this kid, he's in trouble.
It's The timing of this, I think, is key. And I think is frankly the only way that Zach's parents, especially his father, can actually go forward. He graduates from high school in 2010. That's when his football career ends, after suffering three pretty bad concussions his senior year of high school. That is just when talk about concussions and football and CTE are starting to come out. It was that the same month, I think, that he graduated, was when Jean Marie Laskus had this amazing article in GQ about Dr. Benan Amalu, and sort of the guy that, you know, the movie Concussion. She wrote a book about it and became a movie Concussion. This was, the articles were just starting to appear in the New York Times. So Zach's parents, they have they're able to plead innocence and naivete. Parents now aren't. I got two young boys, they're 4 and 8. And it becomes a lot more difficult these days, because we're not in the age of innocence anymore. We can't say that we didn't know the risks of football weren't just a bum knee or a bad shoulder. but right. brain, the very, you know, what makes us human.
Yeah. So on that question, and I don't want to run out of time, I'm going to put you on the spot. You may not have to answer this question as a parent, because there are a number of high schools in the country that have abolished football. And so even if you wanted to play as an athlete, and I know some very big time high schools out east where my brother lives, he didn't have a choice whether his kids were going to play. But I'm going to ask you this question anyway, hypothetically. If they want to play, you can let them play.
Right now I say no, but it's one thing saying no when I'm just downstairs with my 4-year-old watching the Vikings lose on Sundays. It's another thing when he's 12 or 14 and all his friends are going out for the team and I've been watching football with him for a decade and he comes right. to me and says, Dad, I want to do this. And Dad, you wrote this book about football and this book talks about the dangers of football, but I think it also very much talks about the rewards of football. It's a cop-out of an answer, but like, I don't think I'd really have a choice because my wife feels even more strong than myself.
Not a cop-out.
I do think it becomes a much more complicated question if he organically falls in love with this sport and wants to play. I mean, the answer is probably no.
Right. But,
I mean, it would make me a hypocrite. I love football. I'm not going to let my own kids play.
Well, but see, that's a beautiful answer in the sense that I think the country's going through that right now in a way. It's become almost a guilty pleasure. I mean, should I even watch it? Should I even support this, right? And this country loves football. And certain parts of the country love it a hell of a lot. And it's almost impossible to imagine it going away, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like a religion in certain parts of the country. It's like a civic institution. You see small towns in Texas where it's like the biggest piece of infrastructure in the whole town is the high school football stadium, 20,000 seats in a stadium in a town of 12,000. These are very real things. You see in small town Iowa where you have these towns of 2,000 people and it's like on a Friday night, well, the whole town migrates 30 miles down the road for the big game. There is something different about football, I think, that's different than any other sport. The community aspect, the fact that there are just so many people that play, these huge teams.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like the life lessons you get from football, can you get them from basketball? Can you get them from track and field? I think some people would say yes. I'd say probably no. Not these, because football is such a metaphor for life and fighting through pain, sometimes to the detriment of your own brain, but there's something also good about the idea of fighting through pain. So I do hope this book lives in the grays where it's like, if you love football, this book's going to challenge your views on football. If you hate football and thinks it brings nothing positive to our country, this book's going to challenge your views on football.
That's well said. And it does that. And it challenges your views on a lot of things, on society, on America, on who we are. I just think it's got a lot going on in there. We're talking to Reid Forgrieve, author of Love, Zach, Small Town Football and the Life and Death of an American Boy, just out, getting a lot of attention. We're nearing the top of the hour. Reid, what are you working on next? Do you have any big projects or is it?
I got a big Star Tribune story coming out in a week and a half. That is the longest. I started the Star Tribune a year ago and it's the longest story that I've done there. It's like 10,000 words. All Sunday, October 4th. I'm not going to tell you what it's about.
Whoa.
But it has six characters and it's about one of the most important issues that's been going on in 2020. So that narrows it down to like 18 different things, but you can probably guess what it's about.
10,000 words. Is it in their magazine? I mean, where are they going to fit that?
No, they're actually doing a special section for it, which I'm really excited about. And it's a story. I do think it's worth it because it's a story about COVID, but it's a story that just shows the human personal toll of COVID and how it's changed us as human beings in very intimate ways. I'm really proud of the story and I think it'll be, it's a different type of story.
Well, I'm sure it's going to be great. If your book is any indication, that's exciting. We look forward to that, Reid. Boy, we're getting close here. Annie, if you want to pop on. Oh, wrap. I'm getting the wrap. So here we're going to wrap. This is Reid Forgrieve, author of Love, Zach, Small Town Football, and the Life and Death of an American Boy. Thanks, Reid. It's really been a pleasure. Congratulations on the book.
Yeah, great doing this. Great to be on the show. And thanks a bunch.